Welcome to The Final Word, a Bible teaching ministry with pastor, teacher, and author Jim Andrews. The Final Word is grounded on the invincible conviction that what the Bible teaches, God teaches. And that is the last word. On this program, truth still matters. The Bible is in, Babel is out. The Final Word is funded by listeners like you. Should you want to partner with us or want other information about the program, please go to our website at thefinalwordradio.com. There you'll find archives so you can listen to any program you may have missed. Visit us on Facebook at The Final Word Radio and write us a note. We love hearing from our listeners. We'll provide other contact information at the end of the program, so have your pen ready. And now Jim Andrews continues his current study of God's Word.
Good day, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you for joining us on The Final Word. We continue with our exposition of the book of Exodus. We just got into the first verse as the time in our last program expired. Now, when the people saw that Moses delayed to come down from the mountain, the people assembled about Aaron, and they said to him, "Come, make us a God who will go before us. As for this Moses, the man who brought us up from the land of Egypt, we do not know what has become of him." No sooner had the law of God been ratified and Moses had been absent for 40 days on the mount, where he was receiving instructions for regulating the worship of the nation Israel, than the people got it into their heads that Moses had disappeared. He had abandoned them out there in the wilderness to fend for themselves. And if Moses, God's human representative, had gone AWOL, that could only mean that Yahweh had abandoned them. Their response to this situation is a gross violation of the covenant that they had just ratified there at Mount Sinai. They're only about 3 months out of Egypt and into the wilderness. The law had just been given, and they had just affirmed emphatically that they would obey God's law, and they turned right around and trashed it. Thereby, they absolve God of any self-imposed covenantal obligations to them. God owes them zero because right here and right there, they failed their part of the bargain. They disown by their actions the covenant to which they had agreed back in chapter 20, verses 3 through 4. The law of God said, "You shall not make for yourself an idol or any likeness of what is in heaven above or on earth beneath or in the water under the earth." He had said, "You shall have no other gods before me," the very first commandment. The one I previously read was the second commandment. But evidently they figured Moses was history. Yet like all mankind from the beginning of time, these Israelites had to have some kind of God. As the saying goes, when man no longer believes in God, he does not believe in nothing. He starts to believe in anything. How we see that today, which is exactly where they went mentally. Except for the tiny minority of human beings who make a determined, self-conscious effort to eradicate God from their intellectual horizon, human beings, by virtue of that innate God consciousness, implanted there by natural revelation and reinforced by cultural practice, we human beings are reflexively religious. Consequently, these Israelites still very much felt the need of some god or gods to direct them and protect them. In short, they needed a religious security blanket. But their faith in the God, Yahweh, who had been revealing himself to them and had emancipated them from Egypt, turns out to be so shallow, so transient, and their spiritual understanding, even after all they had seen and heard, was still so dense that they would settle for some unspecified gods to impart to them the sense of security they lacked at the moment, some kind of God figure in their own minds to meet their immediate emotional need. In Moses' absence, they felt exposed. So they did what human beings always do in religious matters who do not know the true and living God. They get creative. They fall back on pagan crutches, those kinds so familiar to them from Egypt. By nature, fallen human beings most always opt for a visible, materialized God. Man is more secure and more prone to depend upon things the flesh can relate to, the world of sensory perceptions. Who can explain the stupidity of fallen man, who is better able to depend upon gods he makes with his own two hands, than on the invisible God who made us all by his own creative hand? The nature of fallen man is like that. People always want to tinker with God. People want to reshape God to our own comfortable private conceptions rather than embrace him in his revelational representations. Fallen, natural human beings always downgrade God to make him fit whatever size and shape of deity man wants at the moment. As I said before, man needs religion, and he'll have it in some form, even the atheist. For God made us to be in a relationship with him. And without him, there is what has been called a God-sized vacuum at the center, at the core of human beings. But estranged from God, man will inevitably come up with a God that he can domesticate, a God that man can manipulate, a God that man can propitiate by fleshly means. From their long years in Egypt, this people, Israel, were culturally accustomed to the pagan way of representing deities in material forms. In Egypt, the bull, Apsis, was a well-known representation of the highest Egyptian god, Osiris. Well, up to this point, Moses has been their link with Yahweh, and Moses' special connection and intimacy with God was such that Moses must have seemed that tangible God link that lessened that yearning for a God they could see. But with Moses out of the picture at the top of the mount, had been gone for some time now, he was to be up there 40 days and 40 nights, here this people started to yearn for a God, put that a little g, a God they could see, not an invisible God they couldn't. That was what they had always known in Egypt. You know, the natural man instinctively values the sensible more than the insensible. You know, a bird in the hand is worth two in the bush. Temporal riches are valued more than eternal wealth. Tangible assets more than intangible. Though man was made for God, this fallen flesh gravitates to the things of earth because those gratify the drives and the appetites of this fallen flesh. People sometimes wonder at the devotion and the loyalty of the adherents of false religious systems vis-a-vis the waffling ways of so many who profess to be Christians. Folks, that should not surprise us at all. False religions play to the flesh, not the spirit. Christianity runs against the grain of the flesh, and thus in every believer there's a constant warfare. There's a constant undertow of resistance that one does not find in other religions because the shoe fits the flesh. Well, this apostasy that we encounter here at the opening of Exodus chapter 32 just reminds us how prone mankind is to the influence of acculturation, getting in tune with and in the flow of the culture is what I mean by that term. It reminds us, this apostasy that we're witnessing here, how easy it is by dint of cultural repetition and cultural pervasiveness to just go with the flow, to lapse into folk religion, to form unconsciously our religious concepts and customs, to form them around human imagination rather than around the light and the authority of divine revelation. That's a course that every time will lead us far astray from the proper worship of and walk with the true and living God. Well, we're told here in verse 1, the people assemble about Aaron. The Hebrew preposition translated about Aaron is not the expected one. This one literally means upon Aaron, translated about Aaron. This preposition suggests in the Hebrew that the people were pressing upon him in an impatient, rather insistent way, not in a friendly, compliant manner a people looking to a sage elder statesman for counsel. They're more or less telling Aaron what he's got to do rather than asking him if they can do that. They demand of Aaron, make us gods. That's plural in Hebrew. The Hebrew proper noun, Elohim, is technically plural, and you always have to monitor the context. When it is used with a singular verb, it represents that word Elohim, what we call a plural of majesty, and it refers to God, or literally means the Almighty. Or, depending on the context, this plural Elohim may also mean gods or mighty ones, such as angels or judges. Everything depends on context, like so many of our words in English, in Latin, in Greek, or German, or French, or whatever. The plural verb here would suggest that in this context they were asking for gods, little g, rather than a god, a single god. However, based on the allusion to this event in Nehemiah 9:18, it appears what they had in mind was a visible representation of the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. That didn't make it any less wicked, for that would have been a blatant violation of the second commandment, which they had just covenanted before God to observe. Let me read from Nehemiah 9:18, from which I drew the inference what it appears they had in mind when they said to Aaron, this Moses is gone, he's the best connection to God we had, so let's just get us a physical representation of God, the God who's been leading us since we no longer have this physical representative Moses. Nehemiah says, our fathers acted arrogantly. They became stubborn. They would not listen to thy commandments, and they refused to listen, and they did not remember thy wondrous deeds which thou hadst performed among them. So they became stubborn, and they appointed a leader to return to their slavery in Egypt. But thou art a God of forgiveness, gracious and compassionate, slow to anger, abounding in loving kindness, and thou didst not forsake them. Even when they made for themselves a calf of molten metal and said, this is your God, they pointed to it, there it was, this is your God who brought you up from Egypt, and in the process, Nehemiah says, committed great blasphemies. It is possible by gods, plural, they meant material replicas of a single God image then, as was the case when later in their history, Jeroboam, the king of the northern kingdom, the breakaway northern tribes made two golden calves to represent Yahweh. Jeroboam possibly took his cues from this incident, placing one in the north of the northern kingdom and one at the southern extremity of the northern kingdom, so that there would be no temptation on the part of his citizens in the breakaway northern tribes to traipse to Jerusalem to worship Yahweh. In any event, it simply boggles the mind that a people who had seen such supernatural wonders of God's judgment upon Egypt, such as parting the waters of the Red Sea to save them from the army of Pharaoh, such as healing the waters of Marah so they would have drinkable water, such as providing quail and an ongoing supply of manna to sustain them in the wilderness, such as giving them water from the rock of Horeb, such as guiding them and illuminating their camp by the pillar of cloud by day and fire by night, and had so terrifyingly revealed his glory on the top of Mount Sinai. How could they, after all of this exposure to the grace, the power, the provision, the holiness, and the glory of God, almost immediately after they had sworn themselves to honor Yahweh as their God and be loyal to him and keep his law, his Ten Commandments, almost immediately throw all that away and want to take up with pagan images after the kind they knew from Egypt? I mean, you have to ask, how could one explain this irrational blindness. Well, a couple of timeless lessons we can learn here. One, which I've underscored before, is this. No amount of supernatural revelation, no amount of signs and wonders, miraculous demonstrations, is sufficient for long to compel the faith and the devotion of an unbelieving and unregenerate heart, and in the greater mass of the nation, as the Old Testament and the New Testament tells us, that's what we had here. Only a remnant was believing. Folks, only grace can change the heart so that faith takes living root in revelation. That's the first timeless lesson. The second timeless lesson here is that the minute religion, I'm talking about the worship of God by that term religion, but the minute religion breaks loose from the anchor and the parameters of divine revelation, it begins to drift out to sea on the wild waves of vain human imagination and speculation. And it leads, as we shall see very shortly, to perversion and to corruption. It always does. That corruption, in fact, hear me, is what is driving so much craziness in contemporary Christianity, as congregations and their leaders are less and less anchored to and ruled by the Scriptures alone as their standard, their measure of the Christian faith and Christian practice. That's the reason people in presumably even evangelical churches are giving way to all sorts of subjective flights of fantasy under the good name of the Holy Spirit. I don't think I need to tell most of my listeners that there is chaos out there today. A third timeless lesson that we can learn from this apostasy is that by definition, idolatry is not simply substituting the worship of the true God for a so-called rival deity, but idolatry also encompasses redefining or dumbing down our God concept in such a way that His nature and character is so fundamentally altered that the true God is mistaken for another. And that's what these people were doing here. They were asking Aaron to make them a representation of Yahweh in the form of a calf. And in that way, they were distorting and corrupting and perverting their God image, and creating, really, despite the name, a pagan god. And that's why the Lord said you should never do that. Second commandment, never represent God by any material image, whatever. Because when you do that, you are corrupting and perverting the nature of God. Now let's go back to Aaron, who appears here in chapter 32, verses 1 and following. He appears here in a very bad and disappointing light. Aaron said to them, verse 2, "Tear off the gold rings which are in the ears of your wives, your sons, and your daughters. Bring them to me." Then all the people tore off the gold rings which were in their ears, and they brought them to Aaron. He took this from their hand, he fashioned it with a graving tool, and made it into a molten calf. And they said, after Aaron was finished with his directive fabrication, "This is your God, O Israel, who brought you up from the land of Egypt." And now when Aaron saw this, he built an altar before it, and Aaron proclaimed and said, "Tomorrow shall be a feast to the Lord." Wow. When Aaron is arm in arm with Moses, he appears to be a giant. But here on his own, he comes across as a limp, weak-willed character with no real spine. Aaron obviously does not know God as Moses knew him, and man does it show. You know, you see this phenomenon a lot in life, in contemporary life, where together as a team, two individuals appear to be formidable mutual forces for God. But separated, you will find out one was really the backbone and the ace of the team, who made the other look better than they were. I've seen illustrations of this in pro football. Never played it, but like most people, watched it a lot. There you'll find a player playing alongside some really, truly great player. And they will appear themselves, because they play alongside that person, to be great, and they will get a lot of ink. But they flop when they no longer enjoy the benefit of their truly great teammate. I remember back in the 70s when I was in Denver, the Denver Broncos acquired a number one draft choice, but the guy never panned out. What they finally figured out, so they said, was that the guy this draft choice played beside drew so much attention of opponents that it left the inferior player more room than usual to shine. Consequently, the fellow looked like a great player at the time, but the other guy was the one who made him look so good. Well, that's what you have here with Moses and Aaron. It was Aaron, recall, that Moses placed in the gap during his absence. He turns out, unfortunately, to be a man with a gap. As a personality type, Aaron so much reminds me of the typical evangelical pastor I used to encounter in my younger days in the somewhat liberal denomination in which I was reared. I found these fellows very nice guys who, I believe, in retrospect, knew the Lord, but they were Aarons. They were the kind who went along to get along. They basically had no spine. They didn't want to be sticks in the mud, and they were more than willing to settle for a godless peace and wrongly congratulate themselves for being men of peace rather than men of contention. You perhaps, like me, know the type. They will stick to the truth until it begins to hurt. Then they will rationalize, and invariably they invent some pious-sounding pretext for basically rolling over and letting error have its way. They think that's being gracious. Let me illustrate that more concretely. I was a young, freshly minted pastor of an American Baptist Convention church, the denomination in which I grew up. All of us pastors in what was called the Taze Valley Association, we got together monthly for fellowship and to discuss issues, and these were often stimulating. The men in my particular association were evangelical pastors, all except one. And that one, on a strictly social level, I must tell you, I enjoyed. But Charlie D., the guy I'm talking about, was an unreconstructed theological liberal. He believed, by his own word, virtually nothing that Orthodox Christians have historically affirmed. In my own presence, as a late 20-something, I heard him deny not only the inerrancy and the authority of the Scriptures, but to my face he denied the resurrection, and he scoffed at the idea of the second coming of Christ. Likeable as he was on a personal basis, by the way, later he gave me a lot of good biblical commentaries from his own library, still have them today. To tell you truthfully, I was aghast that all these evangelical men took his belief lying down. They did it regularly. At one fall meeting, the men were setting up a pulpit exchange on a given Sunday. It was just a time of showing solidarity and over time exposing other churches to the association of their pastors. Though I was probably about 27 years old at this point and been a pastor only 2 years, they were going to have me take the most prestigious pulpit in the association, by far. But the biggest shock was that they had scheduled Charlie D., the liberal, to take my pulpit. Right there I knew I was facing a defining situation for my whole ministry. I could be flattered that they had enough confidence in me to send me where they were, but I had a problem. Tune in next time for a continuation of this saga. Thank you for joining us on The Final Word.
The Final Word is a listener-supported ministry. Should you want to partner with us or want other information about this program, please visit our website at thefinalwordradio.com. Our postal address is The Final Word, 4565 Carmen Drive, Lake Oswego, Oregon, 97035. Our email address is info@thefinalwordradio.com. Our phone number is 503-699-9840. If this program has ministered to you, tell a friend about it. We do solicit your prayers for God's hand upon this outreach.